Good evening. My God, what a task. After such a long day and a fascinating meeting, I think the organizers decided to play a trick on me. They know that I'm a tragic optimist, that I've been struggling all my life trying to create feedbacks. I don't know if Alex is okay. We're talking about feedbacks between my political theory and my political activism. And all of a sudden, I'm confronted with a supermarket of monsters. A huge supermarket, and very difficult, in fact, to define. And it goes from extra statecraft infrastructures to the financial capital to create value out of nothing, derivatives, or out of almost nothing, sand. And then the most conventional forms of dictatorship in Syria, the monstrosity of the war and destruction, which we could also multiply in Palestine, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Sudan, in northern Mali, in northern Niger, in northern Nigeria. And therefore, I think this is a moment of disquietude and a moment, I think, of reflection, because what I'd like to discuss with you is that if there is something monstrous about ourselves, we have been discussing and denouncing eloquently all the monsters. Are the monsters and us, or us as monsters? Do we live side by side with the monsters comfortably? Do we live in the benevolent side of the monsters, like the people in Singapore? Well, a great Cuban philosopher, historian, and activist, José Martí, wrote in 1895, because he was at the time in New York, that he was writing from the entrails of the monster. And it was very difficult to write about the struggle in Cuba or in Latin America, the Nuestra America, from New York, from Manhattan. But I think that this is probably even stronger. It's not that we are in the entrails of the monsters. It's because probably we are monsters ourselves. How do I say that? I do say that in a very precise way. Because I see this is not just liquid dictatorship, but a kind of a cloud, a gas, a pollution of dictatorship that seems to be everywhere. And here we are, radical Democrats, living our lives. And the monsters go on undisturbed by our analysis. So I think that the moment of disquietude is very precise in my way, the way probably we have become monsters ourselves. Is that, and this is the precise location, many people have emphasized that, Berlin is a very good location to discuss this, because at the beginning of the last century, there was here very intensively lived and experienced by all the people and particularly the workers in Europe and particularly in Germany, there were two models of progressive social change, progressive social transformation, revolution and democratic reformism. And in fact, there was an intense polarization around these two models. There was no doubt that it would be possible to have progressive transformation. The division was about the ways in which you could achieve that transformation, revolutionary or reformistic. Well, the polarization was so high that some of the most illustrious representatives of the revolutionary option, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, died on January 1519. And it's interesting and dramatic that the body of Rosa Luxemburg was found a few meters away from here, Landwehr Canal, in a few months later after the assassination. What happens now is that we are beginning the 20th century with none of them, neither revolution nor reformism. What we have been discussing is that apparently there is no way of having a progressive social transformation, and this should be a moment of disquietude for us. And why this is monstrous? It's because at the beginning of the 20th century, the idea was that we didn't know enough about society. Social science were developing at the time. If you really know, see, well, the people that were developed, social sciences, that was the beginning of the 20th century. There was Max Weber, there was Durkheim, there was Marx, there were many others. But particularly these three people, they were really very much concerned with the social question in Europe, the destruction, the creative destruction, as Schumpeter would later on call it, of capitalist development, the criminal developments, the prostitution, and the diseases in the cities, the malaria, all these kinds of the dark side of industrialization. That was a big, serious problem. And we didn't have enough knowledge. Enough science. So we start developing social sciences. And these social sciences, in fact, were developed very intensely throughout the century. Now we know a lot. We know a lot about our societies. This meeting is an eloquent manifestation of this deep knowledge. But the results are not brilliant. Now we know a lot. But what happens? Nothing happens when we say that the 8 richest people have as much wealth as the half poorer world population, 3.5 billion people in the world. And nothing happens. There is no revolution. There is nothing. So I think this is monstrous in itself. And since we acquiesce with that, we ourselves are probably monstrous. So I think that at this point, our social science, in fact, were developed to create rebels. But in fact, we created incompetent revolutionaries and incompetent rebels. And in fact, we created basically conformists throughout the century. And we are paying a price for that. And I think that's why I think that we need an epistemological intervention, which I call the epistemologists of the South, is to change the picture so that we can see what's going on in the world with different lenses. That Europe, particularly, should go back to the school of the world as a student, not as a professor. Because I don't think that Europe has nothing to teach, but probably much to learn. The problem is that we have a colonial prejudice that prevents us from learning from the non-Western world. And you could see that it's absolutely natural that we should do that, because when Marx and Durkheim and Weber developed their theories, well, there were 5 countries. There were 4 countries then, Italy and then the United States, 5 countries. They were concerned with the situation in Europe and North America a little bit. They didn't know about the rest of the world. 3/4 of the population were colonies. They were outside. They were not concerned. So they developed theories and science that didn't allow most people in the world to represent the world in their own terms, as their own. Because our theories have been developed in an imperial way so that all the concepts favor the most developed countries, the core countries of the system. Look at this. Development. When we developed the concept of development, no more than 6 countries were developed. And this became the general concept for all the sociological and political intercourse. But there were not many countries that were developed. Most of them were undeveloped. Can't we imagine that a sociologist in Bangladesh would develop such a concept to portray the societies in the world in such a way that most of the societies would be on the wrong side of history, because only a few societies were really on the right side of history. And if you look at the ideal types of Weber, constantly, the developed European societies, the North American societies, are closer to the best ideal types of Weber. None approximates, none realizes the ideal type, because it is an ideal type, but they are closed, for it's a rationality, with all the problems that Weber raises about rationality. So I think we need an epistemological break. And I think that we have to value other knowledge, the knowledges of people in struggle, the people that have been suffering the injustice of capitalism, colonialism, and patriarchy all along. And in fact, most of that knowledge is not considered academic, because our universities really are fully concentrated on the knowledge of the winners, not the knowledge of the losers. They never reached our universities. And therefore, we have a biased view of our of the world in itself. So there is a kind of an epistemology of blindness that prevents us to look at the world in a different way, that we could in fact congregate the type of energies of all those people as like us. I go to Zimbabwe, I go to, you know, everywhere I go, and I see people like you, young people, anxious to do something. And they are doing actually something. But we don't see, we don't value what they are doing. They don't connect. And if in fact the drama of the World Social Forum is that in spite of the fact that we have organized such a marvelous types of gatherings, nothing came out of it. And in fact, we were probably the best proposal. Another world is possible. Don't ask me which world, because we don't know. But at least we know that another world is possible. So I think that there is a first task that I am asking you to do for the future, is that if we go on with these descriptions, it will be very difficult for us to create progressive social change, in my view. I think we have to reduce the monsters to a human dimension, a dimension that you can really confront them and defeat them. Otherwise, you cannot. There is a question of scale that is here at stake. And there is a very important story of the Incas when Cortes arrived in the southern part of Latin America. And probably you know that there's been a surprise for many people in the world that the Incas surrendered mostly. They didn't fight as much as people thought they would fight because they had soldiers, they had weapons, they could fight, but they didn't fight. Why they didn't fight? Because for them, for Cortes, the Incas were the enemies. For the Incas, Cortes was a semi-god, was another form of humanity of a higher degree than the Incas. They were the Incas themselves, but, you know, an upgraded version of the Incas, so to say. So they surrendered because the image they had of Cortes disarmed them to struggle. And I think that sometimes in the social science, we do that. We describe in such a way that it's impossible for the common person, particularly young person, well, what can I do? And I think that's our responsibility to do that. So let's start. Why I think if we take really serious this epistemological break, I'm not going into that. We have some of them know this work, this idea that we have to build ecologies of knowledges. Between the knowledge of the women, the knowledge of the women in struggle, we just heard Samara and the Northern Syria doing work, women's work, peasants' work, indigenous work, all this knowledge that usually we don't really consider as relevant, because we consider relevant only the scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge is very important, but it's one kind of knowledge. In my struggles, for instance, now against agrotoxics in industrial agriculture in Brazil, we know very well that science may be very helpful because science is internally plural. There is one agronomy that is with Monsanto and Bayer, and there is an agronomy that is with the small peasants. That one works with us. But, of course, there are also the knowledge of the MST, the landless movement in Brazil, the knowledge of peasants, the knowledge of women, the knowledge of campesinos, the knowledge of the indigenous people. Try to bring together new forms of knowledge, new aggregations and ecologies of knowledges. And if we do that, then probably we start seeing the world in a different picture. There are probably alternatives there, but we don't see the alternatives because we don't have the theoretical instruments to see them. That's why I keep saying that we don't need alternatives. We need an alternative thinking of alternatives. And that's what I think I would really ask you to try to think of that in order to see then the experiences of the people, how they are in fact trying to have new solutions. Why do they have that? Because they cannot. They cannot afford to be like us, very sometimes very pessimistic, because we have our salaries at the end of the month, because we eat three or four times a day, because we have our security and our protection. So we can be cynical. We can afford to be cynical and pessimistic. But the people that are alive today, and they don't know if they are alive tomorrow, or if they feed the people today and they don't know if they will feed their children tomorrow, these people have to think about tomorrow. That's the major distinction. David, because we have been so much concerned about the future. It's not the future, it's tomorrow. For most people, the future is tomorrow, it's nothing else. And I think for that, we need, in fact, to have instruments that could help to see what they are trying to do in their lives. Non-market economies, non-capitalist economies, refoundations of state, new forms of democracy, new conceptions of dignity. But we don't think that it is relevant compared to the monstrosity of the powers that are before us. So there is a question of lens, which I think that we start. And I'm going to start with the most difficult example, which is democracy. Because in fact, democracy is also monstrous at this point. Because in fact, at the beginning of the 20th century, democracy was an alternative. Reformism was, Bernstein, will arrive at socialism by democratic means. And in fact, the idea was the revolution is good for the underdeveloped countries, like Russia, but not good for Europe. And in fact, the revolution was exported to extra-European territories, and there was no more revolutions in Europe, except revolution in my country in 1974, the Carnation Revolution, but it's a different story, a different genealogy. So I think that democracy was really a way of achieving progressive social change. All of a sudden, rule of law, democracy is imposed as a form of imperialism. That's what democracy is today, liberal democracy. We know of the tension. It would take for a long time to show you the tension between democracy and capitalism. Now we know something. Liberal democracy cannot bring about the end of capitalism or the end of colonialism, but colonialism, capitalism, can bring about the end of democracy, even this liberal democracy, even this very low-intensity democracy that we live by. So I think that if we take that seriously, then probably we'd see what happened then. And what can we do? What happened was very simple and very interesting, is that if you look at all the bibliography in the 70s, 60s, and 70s, the discussion about democracy was the following. Why so few countries are democratic? Because only few countries were democratic then, by the rules of liberal democracy. So all the theory in political science was about the conditions for democracy. I'm sure that you remember his work. There was that study like I did at that time. Barrington Moore was the conditions for democracy. So we needed, for instance, an agrarian reform. Without agrarian reform, no democracy is possible. Without middle classes, no democracy is possible. Without a public system of education or literate people, no democracy is possible. Why, without a balance between peasant and urban populations, no democracy is possible. In the 80s, everything, there was a paradigm shift, and we didn't notice it. Many of the social scientists never noticed it, is that from then on, democracy does not require conditions. Democracy is the condition for everything else. And democracy becomes a conditionality of the World Bank. And Amartya Sen is going to buy this idea, of course. And many others, not him, again. And he is the best in this format. But the idea that from now on, there are no conditions for democracy. Democracy is condition for everything else. So it becomes a conditionality of the World Bank, a conditionality of the IMF. So you should be suspicious. We should have been suspicious of that. But in fact, many social scientists really took that as a progress. In fact, it was not a progress. In fact, it was a trap. And the trap was that democracy came together with neoliberalism, with the liberalization of the markets, with privatization everywhere. Even the end of dictatorship in Brazil came together with neoliberalism, with privatization. So I think that this should tell us, this is a very important story to learn. I mean, these forms of democracy can be instrumentalized. But why so many people are struggling for democracy? And I lived in a dictatorship for a while in my adult life, fascism in Portugal, so I know what democracy is and what it means to have at least civil and political rights. So we have to understand from now on the other story, the other side of democracy is the plurality and diversity of conceptions of democracy that on the ground we can see. And in fact, they were in the theory. They were here in Europe. But look at the Soviets. What was the Soviets? When Lenin writes State and Revolution, what does he think? Or Rosa Luxemburg? They say that they need a state, but it's not the bureaucratic state. For Lenin, is the commune, like the Paris Commune of 1870. And the idea of the Soviets is participatory budgeting, it's participatory democracy. The Soviets were delegates of participatory democracy, and they were multi-party at the time, before the Bolsheviks, of course, took over in November or January of 1918. So there was these forms of participatory democracy, and all of a sudden, all these wealth of ideas about democracy were reduced to liberal democracy, representative democracy, nothing else. While people don't buy that, and I think that, with full respect by my friend Felix, whose fabulous paper I liked so much, I really like now to make a plea for high simplicity, not high complexity. And I'm reminded of Albert Einstein that said that he discovered the theory of relativity because he asked questions that only a child could ask. So sometimes it is important to go back to the very simple questions. And the very simple question is that we have forms of other forms of democracy in which people, in fact, are engaged in active participation in the decision-making process. Well, examples. Well, and I'm going to stick to the examples that I know in my work, and I've been working with them. Well, popular participatory budgeting in Porto Alegre, 1989, it became a great innovation because, in fact, that those cities and many other cities around the country and then around the continent and then in Europe, it was the first time that I saw, as a social scientist, that Europeans were learning from the South. I saw experts from Germany, in fact, and not all of them from leftist parties, sometimes from CDU, going to Brazil to learn how you do the participatory budgeting at the municipal level. So learning from them. And I think this was, and this still is, an instrument that has been inscribed in the lives of people that, in fact, we can have forms of participatory budgeting that are the only ones that can save democracy. I don't think that representative democracy will survive without participatory democracy. And that's why it's not an option between representative or participatory. The two are necessary to protect each other. That's why the Constitution of Bolivia should be also a lesson for us. Because the Constitution of Bolivia said there are three types of democracy, and the three types should be all of them equally protected: representative, participatory, and communitarian. Communitarian is the indigenous forms of deliberation by consensus or by rotation, which we can find also in British Columbia these days. Not just the indigenous and people in Canada, but the city is having today forms of participatory budgeting by rotation. So I think that these forms were not confrontational. They occurred within the state framework. They were trying to make the state more inclusive, more democratic, by combining different forms of democracy. Sometimes they are confrontational. And we have several examples of confrontation. The confrontation of the Zapatistas. Although some of you may know what happened with the Zapatistas in 1994 and all the autonomous caracoles and juntas de buen gobierno in La Selva La Condone in the southern part of Mexico, in Chiapas. It is a fabulous type of form of organization in which, for instance, the schools are in such a way that parents and children go together to school according to certain arrangement called the escuelitas. Well, we can't imagine that parents and children go to the same school. We have a different system. But of course, they are parallel to the state. They are confrontational. And then we have the Comuna of Oaxaca. Nobody knows probably that the Comuna of Oaxaca in 2006 lasted longer than the Paris Commune. And was crushed by violence by the Mexican state and the Mexican armed forces. But there were there no government during those months. The popular assembly of the peoples of Oaxaca governing the city, no crime, no police. And the governor isolated from the people, by the people, because they didn't trust him, because it was a fraudulent elections. So I think that the diversity of this, of situations which I call in my theoretical work, coming out of the political work, liberated zones. They are liberated zones that sometimes occur in communes. Here in Berlin, we know some of the Occupa communities. They sometimes manage to create non-capitalistic, prefigurative, artisanal forms of utopia. And these should be valued because they are prefigurations. They have an education that another way of being and being collectively in solidarity is possible. But there are many other forms. So we have been talking about Syria, such a disaster. But look at Rojava. The libertarian community in northern Syria, the Kurds, are organizing this community, which is remarkable in many ways because it's a stateless society with the People's Assembly, like the circles of citizens that Podemos in Spain started to launch, articulating a new form of party, the party movement, circles of citizens and the party movement. So women, there is no police, there are protection units. Women are a prevalent leadership there because all the leadership in Rojava is dual, men and women. So I think that these innovations, we don't value these things. We tend to discredit everything because, in fact, one bomb, ISIS can destroy that, and if not ISIS, Assad, and if not Assad, Erdogan. But they are doing this, and they have been there for already some years. And we should really respect these initiatives because these are forms of self-government. And in fact, that in my view, they are the things that we have to stick together today. I mean, I that would be my difference with Felix. This, you know, I can't imagine a radical protocol. I can't imagine a radically democratic protocol. I can't imagine a counter-hegemonic protocol, a better protocol, but not. Because protocols are anti-politics, and we need politics. And therefore, we could have both. I'm not against. I think that we could probably have protocols. And sometimes we have protocols. We have protocols in the World Social Forum, of course. Ways of engagement. How can we organize? For the fact that we decide that armed struggle was not allowed in the World Social Forum is a protocol, of course. We use them too. But our protocols are the protocols of the poor, not the protocols of the rich, of the powerful. And therefore, they are not even counted as protocols. So I think that we are at a time that in which we cannot waste experience, progressive experience. And therefore, we should have an epistemological framework that would allow to value this experience as much as we can. And in fact, probably, I don't want to be too simple, but I think that what we have to do is basically trying to convert ruins in seeds. And architects, I've been working with some architects and artists in which this conversion, how can we convert a ruin into a seed? The indigenous people know that though very well in the Andean region. They have converted the concept of Pachamama or concept of Summa Causa into a form of alternative to development. And we could do that with revolution, why not? And with democracy. But we have to do, and that's probably the trick of our time, is that we have to revolutionize democracy and democratize revolution. This is very simple, but it's high simplicity. Thank you very much. I want us to be competent rebels, basically that. Thank you.
That concludes this portrait of the state in six technologies. Please give another round of applause to all our presenters from this evening. Thank you.